Welcome to another episode of the Strength Training for Runners podcast. I am your host, Tim Edgerton, from Foxwood Personal Training in York. Let's kick things off with another kind of roundup of what's been going on in the world athletics scene. And there has been actually a fair bit of action and a fair bit of reasonably impressive action. Of course, we're still in the midst of the pandemic, of lockdown. That's having a massive impact on grassroots level sport, of course. Not much is going on there. And even a relatively elite level of the sport, not a lot of is going on. But at the very top levels, things have been happening and very impressive things have been happening. The World Indoor Athletics Tour has been taking place. And in the meet in Leuven in particular, there was some absolutely outstanding performances. In fact, Gudaf Sege ran 3:53 to break the woman's indoor 1500 meter record, absolutely smashed it. Genzebe Dibaba previously held the record with 3:55, and in the same race, she absolutely destroyed Rory Muir in second place, who herself ran a very, very impressive 3:59, which is a very fast time for female middle distance running over 1500 meters. You know, that would be a world class time outdoors, never mind indoors, and she was a long, long way behind Gudaf Sege. So very impressive running there. At the same meeting, Jakob Ingebrigtsen ran a extremely impressive 1500 meters, 3:31. And I do believe that actually may well have been a European indoor record as well. So superb running from Ingebrigtsen. And in another meeting at Vienna, Keely Hodgson, the young British junior athlete, actually broke the world indoor record over 800 metres with 1:59.03. Super fast running for an 18-year-old girl. That is insanely fast. Well, of course it is. It's a world junior record, or at least I should say it was a world junior record, because that has now gone and been broken again by another athlete. But British junior Keely Hodgson did briefly hold that world junior indoor record for the women's 800 meters. Since then, and in fact this weekend just gone, we've had the European Indoor Championships, and you know, some of those names featured again: Ingebrigtsen, Keely Hodgson. There was a superbly dominant and impressive run from Keely Hodgson to take on the seniors at the European Indoor Championships. By this point, she's just turned 19. Only just turned 19, but she has stepped up to senior level at these European Indoor Championships and won in absolutely dominant fashion. She commanded the race, she controlled the race, and in my mind there was no doubt she was going to be the winner. Dominant from Jakob Ingebrigtsen as well, controlled both the 1500 meters and the 3000 meters. Initially, Ingebrigtsen was actually disqualified from the 1500 meter final. It was a really messy and scrappy race, and he was initially disqualified for, I think, just pushing and shoving, but was reinstated, and I think that was the right decision. You know, I don't think it's clear that there was a case of pushing and shoving from Ingebrigtsen as well as other athletes, but with the case in question with Ingebrigtsen, he didn't gain anything from it. He didn't really damage the performance of any other athlete from it. So it was correct that he should have been reinstated, and he was clearly the class of the field. He would have won regardless. So good that he got reinstated. But, you know, the women's 1500 meter race was also a really scrappy, messy affair. Made for super, super exciting racing. But, you know, there were DQs, disqualifications and reinstatements in that race as well, including Britain's Holly Archer, a relatively unknown name. She stepped up to the plate, got a silver medal in the women's 1500, very impressive run, but was also initially disqualified, but fortunately got reinstated in what was a really scrappy but exciting race. I think one of the highlights for me from these European indoors was actually the women's 3000 meter race, and there was some amazing running from, again, three very much lesser known British athletes. Most people watching would probably not be familiar with the names Amy Eloise Markov, Verity Ockenden, and Amelia Quirk, but they ran superbly well. I think I'm right in saying it was the first time any of those three athletes had ran in a senior GB vest. So they made their GB debuts at senior level, and Amy Eloise Markov ended up with the gold medal. Verity Ockenden, second place, picked up the silver medal, and Amelia Quirk, who ran the majority of the early stages of the race sitting in second place, ended up fading slightly to fifth position. But an outstanding race from all three, to be honest. And it was enjoyable to watch this race for me, because I've commentated on these three athletes in various British Miners Club meetings over the last few years. So it's great to see athletes stepping up from the BMC races, those British Miners Club Grand Prix races, and stepping up a level and performing on the bigger stage at these European Indoor Athletics Championships. Another amazing race was the men's 800 meter final. This was really amazing race. Jamie Webb from Britain took the bronze medal. The Liverpool Harrier got bronze. But would you believe that he actually only finished third, despite the fact that he beat Adam Cashot, the world indoor champion and an outdoor world championship medalist. Emil Tuka, another outdoor world championship medalist over the 800 metres, and Pierre Ambrose Bross, also a medalist outdoors at world level at this distance, but also another one who's won the world indoor title. Webb went ahead and beat all three of those, yet only finished third. That was The two athletes ahead of him were actually relatively unknown athletes, the Poles Patrick Dobek and Mateusz Barkowski. You know, they took the first two spots, and they were probably, in many ways, the least favoured athletes of the race. You had three global medalists in the form of Cashot, Tuka and Ambrose Bos. You had Jamie Webb as well, who actually went into that final as the fastest in the field this winter, yet none of those athletes managed to pull off the win. It was the unknown, relatively speaking, unknown Poles, Dobek and Borkowski, that took the two spots. It was a great race. It was a thrilling race. And we should also mention Elliot Giles was missing from this race. So just to give you an idea of just the strength in depth of British middle distance running right now, Jamie Webb went into this 800 meter final as the fastest in the field. He picked up a bronze medal, but he's not really even the British number one right now. Elliot Giles, currently, you would argue, is the British number one, courtesy of his unbelievable recent, I think it was 1:43 he ran, to go number two in the world all-time lists behind the one and only Wilson Kipketer, ahead of Britain's Seb Coe. Broke Sebco's British record in the process. Elliot Giles is in superb form. I think he picked up an injury just before these championships and therefore pulled out. You know, there was missing names on the British team from, you know, Elliot Giles wasn't here, Laura Muir wasn't here, but we've still managed to pick up a lot of medals and impressive performances, and there's been a lot of impressive running from the British guys recently, and I think it's fair to say British middle distance running is in a vein of form that it's not been in for a long, long, long period of time. But also world athletics, there's such impressive performances being produced in the world right now. And of course, we have to acknowledge the shoes. You know, I think more as time goes on, you can't get away from the fact that the shoes are having a big impact. I think I read somewhere recently that you can estimate that the spikes that the athletes are wearing at the moment, they're worth about 4 seconds per mile. So I guess you'd be looking to run about 4 seconds faster in a 1500 meter race compared to how spikes used to be a few years ago. And you'd be looking to run maybe a couple of seconds quicker over 800 meters. So clearly that's a huge advantage, having the footwear, the technology advances in the footwear that the athletes are benefiting from now. It's also worth mentioning, of course, there are high responders and low responders to the shoes, so not everyone will get that full advantage, but you are looking at a significant performance gain as a result of the technology we're seeing with these shoes at the moment. But nonetheless, you know, there's some, you still have to be fit, you still have to be on form and to run even within that kind of ballpark. So there's some massively impressive performance going on at the moment. Just going back to the European indoors, there's some really, really dramatic racing in the relays as well. Obviously, indoors we only have the 4x4 relays. You can't really have a 4x100m relay indoors with the 200m track. But the British teams picked up a couple of medals in the relays. But what I would be really interested to learn about, and maybe in a future episode of the podcast, we can possibly look into this a little bit, but it'd be really interesting to look into the training setup of maybe the Dutch system at the moment, because the Dutch are producing, in particular, some great 400-meter talent at the moment, particularly, of course, Femke Bol, who is massively dominant in the women's 400-meters individual race, taking gold there, and she was part of the Dutch 4x400-meter relay team in the Europeans. And you know, the Dutch team managed to win the women's 4x4 relay despite some really, 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 really scrappy changeovers. I think, in fact, at one changeover, I'm not sure which changeover it was and which athletes were involved now, but in one of the changeovers, one of the athletes fell over and lost so much ground. I think on leg three, as a result of this changeover, they were so far behind, but still ended up winning the race. You know, they were favourites going into the race, and if it hadn't have been for their messy, messy changeovers, they would have won it by a long way. It would have been an absolutely dominant performance. But, you know, this is actually traditionally, it's opposite to what we traditionally see with the Dutch team. You know, the Dutch, that of course, we've seen Daphne Schippers in recent years be a very dominant sprinter, but you know, traditionally speaking, they don't have the fastest sprinters on the planet, of course, compared to the USA, compared to Jamaica, even maybe compared to Great Britain. But what we traditionally see with them is a super, super well-drilled relay team, really slick, efficient handovers. And even though they don't necessarily have the fastest four sprinters on paper, time after time we've seen them picking up Olympic medals and World Championship medals due to their really slick changeovers. But in this particular case, in the European indoors here, the opposite was true. Their changeovers were messy, but the quality of the four athletes that were in the team on that occasion was just so high that they managed to pull off the win despite their changeovers. So it would be interesting to see what they're doing right now, what their training setup looks like, and maybe that's something we can look into in a future episode. It's always good to look at what the successful nations, the successful teams are doing, look at successful training setups and see if there's any clues that we can learn from. Success always leaves clues. You look at what successful people are doing and you look at the trends between different successful groups. What trends are there? What similar things are they all doing that is leading to that success? So maybe that's something for a future episode. But getting into the training side of things now, let's just take a look at what some of the things we looked at in the previous episode of the podcast. So in the previous episode, we largely focused on resisted sprint training. So we're talking about hill sprints, we're talking about sled sprints, tire sprints, weighted vest sprints, and all the rest of it, and how you can implement it into your training as part of your strength and conditioning program, because it's obviously a much more specific way of overloading the force aspects of your running compared to working in the weights room. Obviously, you can't get as big an overload in terms of force production as you can with plyometric work and with weight training work, and so it's certainly not pure sprint strength training or pure power training in the same sense as lifting weights is and doing various strength training exercises in the gym are, but it has a important role to play in terms of helping with the transfer of training, because obviously the force production due to increased load, increased resistance, whether it be a hill or whether it be the load being pulled with sled pulls or tire pulls, that increased resistance and increased load does increase the force component compared to normal running without that increased load. And so it's a stepping stone. It acts as a bridge, if you like, between the weights room and our normal running training to help with the transfer of training effect, to help ensure that the strength gains you're getting in the gym are resulting in improved running performance. But something I guess I forgot to talk about in that previous episode with respect to resisted sprint training is the magnitude of the resistance that you use. So I thought I'd just talk a little bit about that now. So with when you're pulling a sled or you're pulling a tire to essentially they're the same type of resistance sprint training. You don't really need to differentiate between sled pulling and tire pulling. They both achieve the same objective of increasing the load across a more of a horizontal vector. So when we're doing sled pulls or tire sprints, the general recommendation is to use a weight that is around about 10% of your body weight. Now, some people would argue that that's a fairly outdated recommendation and there's more scientific and more modern methods that we can use in order to achieve the optimal resistance these days. But let's have a look at some of those recommendations and see whether actually they are better or not. Because one thing you've got to realize with sled pulls and tire pulls is actually it's quite problematic to really try and quantify the load because of different friction levels. So if you're performing your sled pulls on the track versus on the grass or even on the track, different tracks, not all tracks are the same. Some tracks are a little bit spongier, some tracks are a little bit harder. So that depending on the surface you're on, the level of friction is obviously going to be different, and that's going to mean the same load, same amount of weight that you're pulling is going to represent a different level of resistance, not to mention different conditions. So if you're doing your session on a wet day versus a dry day, the levels of friction are going to change and that load is going to change. So it actually is very difficult to accurately quantify the load in which you're the load that you're using when doing sled pulls and tire pulls. And I think as a result of this, a more modern, arguably a more scientific recommendation is to select a resistance that results in a 10% reduction in your running speed. So rather than using a load that is 10% of your body weight, you're using a load that causes your running speed to decrease by about 10%. Which for some people may equate to 10% of their body weight. For some people it may be more, some people it may be less. But this is problematic as well because it's quite difficult to accurately assess a 10% reduction in running speed, you know, unless you've got a really fancy camera setup, etc. It's unlikely that you're going to be able to accurately monitor that level of speed decrement. And so I'm not sure about that recommendation of using a load that results in a 10% reduction in sprint speed. I think it sounds good in theory, but in reality, it's a little bit difficult to implement. In reality, probably using a weight of around about 10% of your body weight is as good a recommendation as any. But I guess don't worry about it too much because, like we say, the different friction levels with different surfaces and different conditions, wet or dry, is going to have a big impact as well. One thing you could do is just video your runs and have a look at your technique. And if you feel like your technique is breaking down too much, then maybe you're using too much resistance. You know, it still has to look like a sprint. You know, you shouldn't be really hunched over and your stride length is massively altered and all of those technical factors have gone out of the window. If that's the case, then you are probably using too much load. So use a bit of common sense. You know, if your technique is really breaking down, drop the weight a bit. It needs to resemble good sprinting form, essentially. And if it's not, you're using too much weight. That would be my recommendation there. With hill sprints, so moving away from the sled sprints and tire sprints and moving on to hill sprints, I'm not really aware of any research equating like the angle of a hill to a particular resistance level. So again, it is quite difficult to quantify and quite difficult to say you should be sprinting up a certain angle of hill in order to achieve a certain level of resistance. So what I would say with hill sprints is just focus on controlling what you can control. Make sure you're running on a good surface. You know, make sure it's a fairly level, it's not on a uneven, you've got dints and ruts and things like that, tree roots sticking out, try and get a nice smooth surface. Obviously not a flat surface because you're sprinting up a hill, but try and make sure it's a good smooth surface so you know that you're getting a proper foot strike, that you can put force down into the ground and you don't have to be concerned about what you're putting your force on. There's not going to be any potholes, any little dips or anything like that. So good surface, make sure you're using a good surface. Make sure the duration of the sprint is about right. I think we talked about this in the previous episode, but around about 10 seconds is what you should be aiming for. Maximal effort sprint for about 10 seconds duration would be perfect, but make sure it is maximal effort. And in order to make sure you're genuinely producing a maximal effort, you need to make sure the rest periods are long enough as well. So yeah, don't worry so much about how steep the hill is. Just make sure you've got a good surface. The efforts are absolutely maximal. You're taking good recoveries and the sprints are about 10 seconds duration. And that should serve you well as a real genuine power type training session. Obviously you might not be producing as much power compared to being in the gym performing, for example, an Olympic lift or a jump squat or something like that, but it's the transfer effect we're looking for. It's making sure the gains we get in the gym do result in improved running performance, and they're not simply making us more powerful and stronger in the gym and in the gym alone. Some additional options that we can look into with resisted sprint training is, well, I guess kind of taking it away from the sprint training aspect, but keeping the resistance aspect, you know, and we can use hills and things like that in other ways, just to get a bit more variety in the training. So one thing I've used, and one thing a lot of famous athletes have used in the past and in the present as well, in fact, is sand dune training. So Steve Ovett in particular is famous for having used the sand dunes of Merthyr Mawr in South Wales. And I know James Thee, with his training group in Cardiff, often travel to the Merthyr Mawr sand dunes. I think it's Ogmore by Sea where those dunes are. And in fact, the Big Dipper is the most famous sand dune in that kind of collection of dunes in that area. And I believe the Big Dipper is the largest sand dune in the whole of Europe. And I ran up it myself, and I can attest to the fact that it's absolutely brutal. I forget exactly how long it took me to run up it. I think it was under a minute, but not much under a minute. And it was brutal. It's your legs are jelly when you get to the top. And you, trust me, you're not, even though the effort is maximal, you're not moving all that fast by the time you get to the top. The first time I ran up this hill was in a BMC training camp, I think, back in 1999. It was a weekend training camp put on by the British Milers Club. And we did a few repetitions up the Big Dipper. And that was my first experience of it. During my university days, I went to university in Cardiff. And so I wasn't too far away from the Big Dipper and the dunes of Merthyr Mawr. And so I, of course, made a few trips over to Merthyr Mawr for some sand dune training during those days as well. And it's a really testing training session. I wouldn't recommend you do that kind of work too often, because just like I was saying with the hill sprints before and the tire sprints and the sled sprints, you don't want to be selecting a level of resistance with those activities that massively changes your technique. And the thing with these sand dune workouts is it will massively change your technique. You're not going to be looking like you're sprinting fast. And in fact, you're not going to be sprinting fast. It really changes your running. And so you don't want to be doing it very often. But it is useful just to do occasionally, just to change your training up a little bit, just to mix things up, provide a different type of stimulus and do something that's just really, really hard. And that can have a good positive effect on your training. It's, you know, it serves a few purposes. It's just generally, it's hard muscular endurance training, but it's also good lactate tolerance training. You know, the feeling of acidosis in your legs muscles after a few of these sand dune sprints is like nothing else. And yeah, just the very occasional use helps to provide a change and helps to provide variety, but you just don't want to be doing, in my opinion, you don't want to be doing it too often. And Frank Horwell, the founder of the BMC, and in fact the coach who was leading those sand dune sessions in my first experience of the Big Dipper and Merthyr Moor, back in that BMC training camp in 1999, he told a story about how a lot of the Welsh athletes, when they trained on these dunes, they would beat the English athletes to the top of the Big Dipper. Like all of the Welsh athletes would be first to the top of the hill, and the English athletes would be trailing behind them, even though pretty much all of the English athletes had faster track PBs than them. They just couldn't compete with the Welsh athletes on the Big Dipper because the Welsh athletes had probably just trained too much on the Big Dipper, and it had possibly, to the extent that it was possibly negatively affecting their track running performance because it was changing their technique. They were using a more efficient style of running to get up the sand dune, but that wasn't having a positive impact on their track running. So I think the moral of the story is it can have a place, but try and use it sparingly, use it judiciously, just use it for a change. And of course, not many athletes most athletes don't live all that near to the sand dunes anyway, so by necessity it's not going to be something that you do all the time. But the occasional trip to the seaside for something different, something hard, some good general hard graft, it could serve a useful purpose there. And so I would look into that as an occasional training tool to use. So aside from that, on the lines of kind of bridging the gap between the weights room and other strength and conditioning activities, I guess another strength and conditioning tool or another area that could be classified as strength and conditioning work that I've not really touched on these podcasts is running technique drills. And I think I've avoided talking about this as it's hard to convey what I'm talking about in a purely audio format. You know, when you're talking about running drills, it's the easiest way of conveying the message is to, you know, show a video or a picture of the running drill in question. So I think for this reason, I've been reluctant to go into too much detail about running drills. At the same time, though, I guess it'd be wrong not to at least mention running drills because they can form a part of the overall strength and conditioning package in terms of what you can do as a runner. So some runners may possibly go over the top with running drills, but I guess my approach with running drills is just to have a few simple variations and include them as part of your warm-up before track sessions. So they're being placed in kind of the warm-up section of a training session into before your track sessions, but there are strength and conditioning benefits to be had from them as well because they're training your ability to put force into the track and be more forceful with your foot placements. And the main drills that I've used have been the A march, the A skip, the B skip, and bounding for heights. Obviously, I'm not going to talk about the technique of the drills because, like I say, it's more of a visual thing, really. But you can Google these, you can YouTube these in terms of what these drills are. But yeah, if you wanted to look into running drills, I would look into the A march, the A skip, and the B skip. And I think bounding for height has a good place in the program as well because I think I've touched on this before, but top speed running performance is a big determinant of how fast your top speed will be, is how much force you can produce into the ground in a vertical direction. So bounding for height is obviously emphasizing that vertical component of force production, and for that reason I really like it in the program, and it's a good use of your time, I think. Touching on other things we can do from a strength and conditioning perspective, I just want to talk about something I've learned from Steve Ball, actually. I think I've mentioned Steve Ball on several occasions within previous episodes of the podcast. He's got an elite 400 meter training group in Manchester. He uses stand work a lot in the winter as part of the warm-up before track session. So just as I was talking about using drills in the warm-up before a track session, Steve Ball often will use stand work, mainly in the winter part of the training cycle, but in kind of as part of the warm-up really before the main aspect of a track session. And he uses a very variety of exercises for this stand work, you know, sprinting up the steps, making sure you're not kind of taking two steps at a time, but making sure you hit every step forcefully and quickly, and then doing double-footed jumps up the steps, lunges up the steps, single leg ups, hops up the steps. So a variety of different kind of, some more speed-based exercises, some more kind of basic strength exercises, and some more plyometric jump type exercises to get in a variety of different types of kind of strength and conditioning work. But the beauty of doing it up the steps is it doesn't take too much out of you from a recovery perspective, because it reduces the eccentric component. So most of the athletes in Steve Ball's group will do separate strength and conditioning sessions as well. But this is a useful top up to those that is mostly focused on concentric work, concentric power, and therefore doesn't require as much recovery. I mean, you can do it before the track session, it's not going to take too much out of you, and you can do it in addition to your main strength and conditioning sessions as well, because it's not too fatiguing and it's not too taxing. So I think by just touching on some of these additional areas, I think I've covered most areas that you can look at now from a strength and conditioning perspective as a runner. Of course, you can do stuff in the weight room, you can do stuff at home that we've talked a lot about, stuff that you can do at home recently in recent episodes due to the ongoing pandemic. Gyms are closed, you can't get to the gym, so you have to make do at home. But you can use your hills, you can use the stands in the athletic stadium, you can use tires and sleds for additional resistance, you can do runs up sand dunes, you can do running drills. You know, the overall strength and conditioning package is diverse, but it's how you place it within the program that's important as well. You know, certain aspects can be included as part of your warm-up for a track session. Other aspects are possibly best served by having their own separate and distinct session. But with those sessions, of course, you also need to make sure they're being placed in the appropriate stage of the week. You don't want them to negatively impact upon subsequent track sessions. So you might not be wanting to do a separate strength and conditioning session in the day or two before a key track session. You know, you have to take into consideration all of these things in order to plan your training week as optimally as possible. So I hope that was useful, kind of a slightly different take on strength and conditioning work this time, equally important. So if you've got any questions, you can always reach out to me. My social media is at Foxwood Personal Training on Instagram. On Facebook, it's of course facebook.com/Foxwood Personal Training. I have a website as well, foxwoodpersonaltraining.co.uk, and you can send me a message through the website. If you've got any questions, or if you want me to cover additional topics in the future, just let me know. I'd be happy to do so. If you're enjoying the podcast and you want to support the podcast, I have a coffee page as well where you can donate the cost of a coffee should you wish to do so. I will leave a link to that in the description of the podcast. And aside from that, I look forward to seeing you in the next episode. So I'll see you soon, and catch you later, guys.